You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Center for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to human rights and international law. I'm Kirsten, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we will be talking with Courtney Curran. Courtney is not only a School of Law doctoral scholar at the Irish Center for Human Rights, but also an Australian qualified solicitor, bringing a wealth of experience with investigated and prosecutorial agencies. Her journey unfolds at the intersection of academia and legal practice, making her a unique and influential voice in the field. Currently immersed in her doctoral research, Courtney explores the intricacies of transitional justice theory, archival research, and legal proceedings with a focus on expansive extraterritorial jurisdictional grounds. This includes the fascinating realm of universal jurisdiction within the broader context of human rights and international criminal law frameworks. Courtney's academic pursuits have taken her across continents with fieldwork conducted in Europe and Australia. Notably, her doctoral research has delved into archives connected to legal cases originating from the Latin American context, shedding light on critical issues in the pursuit of justice. Courtney's contributions don't stop at academia. She actively engages in legal practice both domestically and internationally, with recent involvement at the Kosovo Specialist Chambers adding a real-world dimension to her academic endeavors. Courtney's commitment to bridging theory and practice is evident in her continued efforts in the legal arenas, providing a holistic perspective to her audience. Her dedication has not gone unnoticed, as she has not only published her research in reputable peer-reviewed journals, but also shared her insight with esteemed international audiences through compelling presentations. As we unravel Courtney's impactful journey, we gain insight into the complex and interconnected realms of law, human rights, and international justice. Join us as we explore the mind behind the research, the experiences that shaped her perspective, and the exciting developments on the horizon. Courtney's PhD is set for completion this year, marking a milestone in a career dedicated to making a difference in the world of law and justice. Hi, Courtney. Thank you for joining us today. Today, we want to focus on your recently published blog with the Irish Center for Human Rights. It is titled The Kosovo Specialist Chambers, An Insatiable Creature with a Preference for ICTY Leftovers. Before we fully dive into the article, can you tell us a bit more about your key research area?
Yeah, thank you for having me. I am currently, just absorbed by international criminal law, transitional justice theory, and expansive jurisdictional ground, so including universal jurisdiction, and that's operating using national infrastructures to address international criminality. So at the moment, we are seeing an absolutely huge resurgence in popularity of universal jurisdiction, and that's even since I began my doctoral studies back in 2019. TRIAL International, so that's T-R-I-A-L, they have an incredible resource that maps out a universal jurisdiction database of cases progressing on these expansive grounds. I really encourage you to go check it out. It's really interactive and educational. I actually, in preparation for this chat, I was having a look only days ago that there are Swiss attorneys lodging the first such complaint using these novel jurisdictional grounds against a visiting Israeli president for atrocities being committed against Palestinians in Gaza. Now, that's notwithstanding consideration of immunity issues, but in any event, it's an incredible development, especially given the present international institutional paralysis that seems to be persisting. And it just proves yet again the necessity of having universal jurisdiction available to enable domestic avenues to pursue gross human rights offenders where impunity exists and persists. So a challenge in cases progressing on these kinds of grounds in third-party countries is the availability of and access to evidence. So how do you get it if it's not in the country that's investigating the crimes? rather. How do you ensure its authenticity? Who will admit it into evidence? How will you convince judges and juries in distinct settings of its reliability? Are just some of the very vexing, complex questions that these kinds of matters raise. So these are really important questions that must be grappled with to ensure that when evidence is collected, it's done so bearing these key evidentiary issues in mind to bolster downstream accountability efforts. And really, that's a key aspect of my work.
Well, thank you, Courtney. That's amazing. And could you give us a bit more insight into how this interest developed? I know it's becoming more prevalent and timely. So how did your original interest develop in this?
Yeah, so it's hard to kind of pinpoint, but when I was kind of thinking back and reflecting, it brought me to, so I'm a lawyer. I've been practicing in a number of investigative and prosecutorial agencies here in Australia and also overseas. So yeah, I'm no stranger to wading through voluminous call records, surveillance logs, evidence briefs, and other archival material. I would categorize it as, so including, for example, bank account statements and the like. So often in complex fraud and corruption type matters, to distill relevant admissible evidence to bolster briefs of evidence and give advice and recommendations as to what to charge. So I think this is really my takeoff point, if you can call it that, into academia, as I became really interested in the way that crime leaves behind damning paper trails. So this idea that repressive regimes scrupulously document their state-sanctioned terror, later being harnessed and used to condemn the same perpetrators that created them by the groups that they had tried to destroy, it's just incredibly empowering and fascinating the way that victim survivor communities utilize these archives as they fight and demand for truth and justice in myriad ways and venues. So I was totally inspired by the works of scholars Michelle Caswell and Eric Kettler in this regard, who delve into the Nazi regime and Pol Pot's Cambodia, both regimes of which fastidiously recorded the murders of millions, the tortures and disappearances of so many. So these state-created archives that contain these incredibly powerful, incredibly accurate, undeniably convincing evidence of the terror apparatus created and maintained by the state themselves operating in dictatorships. And just as another example, that was seen across the Latin American cone during the 70s and 80s. And some of my case studies emanate from that context. So these archives, they remain untapped. They have remained untapped, rather, until some very clever lawyers, activists, victims, survivors, and judges began to start using them to build incredibly strong cases against regime leaders. So that's kind of where my research is now focused.
Amazing. And so you mentioned untapped archival repositories. So can you explain this a little bit further for our listeners and what you might mean by that?
Yeah, so I think just picking up where I ended that last point. So my research focuses on archives of state institutions, as I just introduced a bit earlier. So state institutions, records thereof, think of police records, national archives, immigration information, and records that might thereafter be created by truth commissions, courts, and human rights organisations that compile records of the missing during the periods of repression. So, I mean, what I've found as well is just that the human resilience to do this during such harrowing times is just unimaginable. But it is precisely these courageous efforts that eventually do bring those responsible to account. I really wanted to highlight that this is a vital lesson that needs to be had regard to and learned for present conflict context. So what I urge practitioners in this field is to not stop going to domestic courts, even if efforts seem futile in the face of atrocity, because it's precisely those habeas corpus files, for example, that end up bolstering calls for international intervention, that create media exposés, that make international headline news. I attended a conference only about 2 weeks ago about the inability of Palestinians and their legal representatives to get any traction whatsoever in Israeli courts for decades. And this is prior to the, you know, the horror that we're seeing unfolding in that context. But while I was watching this conference, I was just hoping against hope that the court files that had been compiled, even if they were ruled against, and even if they seemed, you know, that they weren't going anywhere for the time being, I just, yeah, just hope that they have been stored somewhere safe for later accountability purposes, because they are just so critical to accountability pathways to come. And just following on from that, my research supports the proposition that a temporal gap is needed after atrocity to facilitate effective transitional justice processes, because usually, I mean, and it makes all the sense in the world, but implicated states are unwilling or unable to investigate and prosecute those responsible for the atrocities in their jurisdictions, given overwhelmingly they're involved. So it usually takes decades. And using the case of Chile again, which is an incredibly useful example in this context, being the cradle of transitional justice. So last year, it marked its 50th anniversary of the coup d'etat, which saw Pinochet come to power by force. And still to this day, I've been following an extradition matter involving an alleged Pinochet-era torturer and secret police operative to face trial in Chile, which remains ongoing. So I guess coming back to your question, you know, what are untapped archives? So again, having regard to this extradition request to Australia, where the accused still remains. So these kinds of documents I've been talking about, these archives created by human rights organisations, records created between state officials, including by the CIA in that case, and other Latin American dictatorship leaders, and Truth Commission evidence, it's all there in the extradition bundle. They need to be identified and explained to judges and juries in diverse settings in a way that informs them of the given context in which they were created, who created the files and why. So really this untaps the potential of the archives. And especially that's really what needs to be done when they're being utilized in diverse settings. And that really, really supports these more expansive jurisdictional grounds by which universal jurisdiction cases may be brought.
That is extremely fascinating. I think for myself, even just the temporal gap that you mentioned, just I think a lot of times people are quick to assume that these international cases or regional cases are taking so long to be held, but there is that importance of waiting until we can go through the archives and gain that evidence in a better manner. So I think that's extremely interesting. So now turning to your article, I found the portion on archival incongruities deeply interesting. Once again, I think many of us are quick to take archives as they are and not to look too much further. So you mentioned looking outside of the Kosovo specialist chambers and seeking information through disassociated archival databases. So can you tell us what led you to do this and go on a different path and what you found while doing this?
Yeah, sure. And I guess just picking up from what you were saying regarding the time that's needed for these kinds of cases to run. You're exactly right. And not only do these complex evidence matrices need to be formulated, but there also needs to be a degree of political willingness to engage in these kinds of cases that are run on really innovative grounds, especially for some jurisdictions that have not been as willing to pursue such cases. And together with the political willingness that's necessary in my own research is civil society mobilisation. And it's not just isolated to the context in which the case is trying to be run, but the need for transnational networks is crucial. And as we were saying before, you know, the evidence most likely is far away and needs to be assimilated so that it can be made used effectively in that third party state. So yeah, it's really the temporal gap is necessary, even though, you know, the wheels of justice move slowly, but nevertheless, because of the conflict context, being Chile, 50 years has passed and still we are seeing victim survivor communities mobilize and come up with other ways to counter impunity that's persisting. Mm-hmm. Now, just in response to your question regarding my article in relation to the section concerning archival incongruities and looking outside of the Kosovo Specialist Chambers databases specifically, I think I'll just give you a practical example in response to that. And I do speak about it a bit in the article, but essentially during my tenure there, I was tasked with crunching evidence. So evidence that had been disclosed by the prosecution, the SPO, in preparation for cross-examination plans for counsel for upcoming witnesses. So because some of the witnesses had given testimony at earlier connected local court cases, so in Pristina, in Kosovo, and at the ICTY, to name but a few, it was absolutely necessary to find those statements and transcripts of those oral testimony to look for and identify and understand inconsistencies in versions provided. I also needed to check for judicial findings in relation to the evidence given by those witnesses, because if a court had found the evidence to be credible and there was a finding on that, really, unless there's cogent reasons to deviate, the court really ought to uphold such findings based on the doctrine of precedent.
Mm-hmm.
So in my experience, external databases, including databases that store ICTY evidence, for example, as well as media repositories, historical and contemporary, they really need to be consulted rigorously to ensure the evidence review is done competently and comprehensively. It's a massive task, but it's just so important that that's done well.
And so you mentioned the ICTY. So how are these archives critical to presenting alternative versions?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily just alternative versions per se, but the ICTY archives, or, you know, other archives for that matter, they might dilute versions postulated by the other side. So, and that's if we're talking about judicial or in quasi-judicial settings. But just referring to the doctrine of precedent again, even though this need not be strictly followed at the Kosovo Specialist Chambers specifically, as I mentioned, generally it ought to. And in the event past judicial findings are not aired before the panel of the Kosovo Specialist Chambers, for instance, so even if those findings are to be aired and opposed by New York or divergent evidence, there would be a real risk that duplicitous findings are made that might even conflict or impinge one another. And this is the really key thing. This would be just so incredibly damaging to the fabric of the international criminal justice project more broadly. So it's just really, it's just, I can't stress how important it is to dedicate sufficient time and resources to ensuring this exercise is completed as comprehensively as possible. To have conflicting judicial findings, it wouldn't do much to the legitimacy of the International Criminal Justice Project.
And so you mentioned that sufficient amount of time and resources need to be exercised. And you're one of the people who are involved in doing this, but how do you think the process can be improved in this respect and going forward?
Yeah, so I guess I spoke this a bit in the article, but just following on from that point around legitimacy, there truly is such a need in what I've seen. And I think it's a really wonderful opportunity for specialist archivists that can value add together with, you know, in multidisciplinary teams of legal professionals and other staff that I worked with while I was at the Kosovo Specialist Chambers that are brilliant at their jobs. But I do think that there is an opportunity to embed archivists into these multidisciplinary teams to value add in fact finding. So during that investigative phase and in the prosecutorial outfits during trial proceedings. And that's really to ensure that those archival types that we've discussed can be identified and layered to really ensure the robustness of the briefs of evidence or the defence proffered. And I guess another aspect of that and what my research supports is that the categorisation and preservation of archival material during conflict and in post-conflict contexts, really, it's just so critical to ensuring that accountability pathways have the best chance to run and succeed, and also to afford affected communities the capacity to exercise their fundamental right to truth and to reparation. So I just wanted to, that just makes me think of the ICC prosecutor recently showed the world that he has the liberty to call on state donors to support his work and his mandate, if we think of the Ukrainian situation. Now, a significant portion of that money, I think, ought to fund efforts to manage the huge data repositories for fear of it being completely useless in downstream trial settings. So I'll give you an example. There is an online portal for user-generated open source evidence that you or I can upload straight from our phones. That's if we believe we have evidence or information that might assist inquiries into the Ukrainian situation. So again, I'm just going to throw some questions out to just show you the complexity that this raises insofar as, you know, trial proceedings or judicial accountability objectives are concerned. So what entity owns that information? Who manages it? Where is it stored? Who will testify to its authenticity? Should there be a stock standard approach, or does it need to be malleable to suit respective conflict contexts? And how is this then reconciled at court? Yeah, as I mean, you can see those questions are not easy to solve. There's a lot of research in this area, really, really incredible work, including by the likes of Professor Yvonne McDermott. And it really dovetails into the work that I'm doing on archives. And so I suppose just to kind of wrap all that up, this material, together with archival evidence, it can bring justice for those responsible for the horror, you know, that we're seeing humanity endure. But we need to learn from past truth and justice-seeking efforts that we need to be as prepared as possible to confront and address impunity. So with new and emerging evidentiary types changing the face of evidentiary matrices in trials, in truth commissions, and in memory initiatives. So yeah, I'll leave it there, but I'm hopeful that we can be better prepared.
Well, thank you, Courtney. I think I want to highlight once again that your research is extremely timely and super interesting as we continue to see conflicts and post-conflict settings across the globe. And as you mentioned, us having the access to give evidence from our phones. I think it's just extremely important that we ask those questions that you posed from a legal standpoint. But yeah, thank you so much for being with us. And I will link your article in the bottom of this episode, and I encourage everyone to go read it. It is extremely fascinating. And I know if you go to the ICHR website, there is more information on Courtney. So thank you for being here today.
You have been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway and supported by the University's Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. This episode was produced by Kirsten Larson.